So you know that friend that you have, you know, the one that exaggerates everything? Kind of like that story of the boy who cried wolf growing up, but this friend suddenly has not only the best life anyone could ever imagine with loads of money, tons of friends, amazing vacations, and, you know, nothing ever seems to go wrong. P.S. Instagram is a drug, friends.
Or, I don't know, maybe this is a friend who's never done anything wrong in their life, right? Like when something goes wrong or something gets blamed on them, it is never their fault, but it is literally the fault of anyone and everyone else around them, right? This is a friend who, when you hear another story from them, you roll your eyes and you go, okay, Jenny, and basically dismiss everything they're saying as fantasy. Why are we friends with them again?
I know, right? Okay, so let's take those friends. And now let's imagine that friend is running, let's say again, for president of the United States. And that friend is bringing that energy into the race in the most destructive, divisive way possible, in which said friend is only out for himself. And his statements prove that every single day. And you know those statements that you would roll your eyes at and dismiss? Now, guess what? You no longer can, because those statements tell you who he is and exactly what he plans to do if he gets reelected. Spoiler alert, it's going to be hugely destructive to our lives as we know them, and most, if not all, of our freedoms that we take for granted. So if you're listening and playing along, you guessed it. We're talking about Trump and why we need to take him at his word. In other words, even though it is extremely painful, don't look away. He is giving us, through his words, the blueprint of how a Trump presidency would be. And not only is it way worse than last time, it will destroy our democracy and our freedoms along with it.
Welcome to the Dear White Women podcast, the show that helps white women use their privilege to uproot systemic racism without centering themselves in the process. If you ever wondered why we are an independent podcast that bootstraps all of our costs ourselves, this is the episode that will tell you why. We are using our voice and we are not being hampered by any sponsors who are going to tell us what we need to say. The episode is officially titled Why We Need to Take Trump at His Word, Don't Look Away, but it could also be titled Laughing When You Feel Like Crying. We are your biracial Japanese and white hosts, Sarah and me, Sasha.
Okay, I love our alternate title. And I've got to say that typically when I write these episodes, I'm searching the internet for examples and facts around what we're talking about. And it can take like a full minute to do that. This time, however, it's like the facts and instances are falling into my lap, because every time Trump opens his mouth, he says something that is incredibly offensive, divisive, off-putting, or, you know, really all of the above. That said, I still waited until the day before we were going to record this episode because, like I said, maybe he opened his mouth on Sunday or Monday, as we record on Tuesdays. But first, to back things up a little bit, we've got to discuss the key question. Why don't people take the threat that Trump poses seriously? Because after all, the Wall Street Journal editorial board wrote in December 2023, "We think American institutions are strong enough to contain whatever designs Mr. Trump has to abuse presidential power," while suggesting that the real danger that could come from a second Trump administration is that he would set up the left for huge gains in 2026 and 2028. Okay, huge eye roll right here.
Eye roll. Yes, eye roll to that.
Okay, and let's not forget, others have adopted a fatalistic both sides approach to what we would consider this to be a looming crisis. As one writer at the National Review asked, "If our existing checks and balances under the Constitution aren't strong enough to stop abuses of power by Trump, why would you think that they're strong enough to stop abuses of power by Joe Biden or anyone else?"
I mean, let's just start with the fact that, I don't know, some people have a moral compass and did not like say, oh, I could walk down the New York City street and kill somebody and my followers would still like me. That was loosely paraphrased or whatever. But because there is a moral compass for most other people. So anyway.
Right. Very basic, but true. And so also, when we think about this, ex-CNN anchor Chris Cuomo, who covered Trump extensively in his former job, said that even though Trump made life hard for my family, he was open to voting for him in 2024 because we survived a Trump administration. Would we survive another one? Yes. Yes. I don't think there's any greater risk to America with him than with Biden.
For what it's worth, I don't think it'll be a shocker. We wildly disagree with Chris Cuomo on this.
Yeah, because is survival our bar here? And I don't even know if that's true. So
right. Well, I mean, and what does survival look like? Survival under an authoritarian regime? Yeah. Okay. But is that the survival we want? No.
Yes, exactly. And so Democratic turned independent former Senator Joe Lieberman, a prominent booster of efforts by No Labels to recruit a third party 2024 presidential candidate, which they have now given up, has a similar take to Chris Cuomo. "This is such a strong country and our laws are so strong," he told Intelligencer. "Trump lost 60 cases and he had to accept the final judgment of the courts." Well, he didn't accept it, but Congress came back from recess and got it done. I can't even say that without laughing because that's so ridiculous.
Right. So I think one has to ask, why does the belief, whether it's genuine or performative, persist that if Trump regains power, somehow his authoritarianism will be contained? Right. Like, how can his references to dictatorship be construed as humor at this point? Why do so many people still refuse to take Trump at his word? Time and again, predictions that Trump was not serious have proved disastrously incorrect. And yet pundits and officials, mainly on the political right, continue to make them, having failed to basically internalize lessons from these past errors. Misasha, can you shed a little bit more light for us on why this might be?
Well, David Frum has suggested in The Atlantic that it stems from an ordinary human failure. "For all its marvelous creativity, the human imagination often fails when turned to the future," Frum wrote. "When Donald Trump is the subject, imagination falters further. Trump operates so far outside the normal bounds of human behavior, never mind normal political behavior, that it is difficult to accept what he may actually do, even when he declares his intentions openly," which is, I think, a really important point to make. Like, if he is so far outside of what you can conceptualize, then it's really hard to also conceptualize what he's saying and take it to be true. So, with that in mind, let's take a deeper look at this phenomenon through Trump's own words. And I think it makes sense to start with some of the key statements that he's made since becoming the presumptive Republican nominee back in March. And really, what better one to start with than his statements about immigration, especially since both of us are daughters of immigrants.
I love that you just personalized this. Absolutely. And what I'm excited about for those listeners who are still with us right now, hopefully you will know that not only are we going to talk about immigration, but we're going to talk about things like his violence, about Ukraine, about the deconstruction of the press. I mean, basically, we want to start giving you a playbook issue by issue of what he is saying he's going to create. So you feel like all of the news has been condensed and you remember the key points so you can stand firm in your opinion and start talking to other people about this as well.
I love you that you said playbook, by the way, because funny, he has one.
No, we're going to come back to that. Yes.
So funny. Okay. Starting with immigration, though, according to many news sources, including the Anti-Racism Daily newsletter, Trump was campaigning in Ohio for Republican Senate candidate Bernie Moreno when he offered these thoughts about immigrants. "I don't know if you call them people. In some cases, they're not people, in my opinion. But I'm not allowed to say that because the radical left said that's a terrible thing to say." I mean, that's not the first time he said something as patently offensive as that about immigrants, though. And like, let's just rewind for a second. He said that they're not people.
I don't know. Is your dad a person, Misasha?
I would say yes. Yes. Your mom?
My mom's a person too. Yeah. She frustrates me sometimes, sure. But she's still a person.
Keeping it all the way real here.
Yes. love her. I do love her.
And I think, you know, let's not forget that he started his first presidential run with a very similar statement, a very similar anti-immigrant statement. But back in October of 2023, which, you know, obviously wasn't that long ago, Trump stated that immigrants from South America, Africa, and Asia are poisoning the blood of our country, which is, you know, echoing language often used by white supremacists and nativists against non-white communities. He followed by saying, "It's so bad, and people are coming in with disease. People are coming in with every possible thing that you can have." Says the COVID denier. I still have I can understand because this is so far outside the bounds of normal human reality and how we talk about people that it is very hard to conceptualize that someone is saying this for real. But he is. Because let's go back or actually move forward in time to March of this year, 2024, at a campaign rally in Georgia, when he said this about immigrants. I will end the agony of our people, the plunder of our cities, the sacking of our towns, the violation of our citizens, and the conquest of our country. They're conquering our country. These people are conquering our country. They're horrible people. Okay, so let's just let that one set in for a second. And as Anti-Racism Daily notes, this hateful rhetoric is rooted in falsehoods. I mean, that hopefully is obvious, but to enumerate them, immigrant communities are actually less likely to commit crimes than the general population, for one. But
and I'll emphasize that we have a whole chapter on this in our book as well, like deconstructing this immigrant myth. So if you need another resource because you're a reader, not a listener, go look at that.
Totally. But I think that is what he said is promoting real policies that Trump plans to implement if he wins, which are honestly terrifying because he hopes to create massive deportation camps, sound familiar, to detain immigrants and implement a process to deport them without due process, which is kind of a hallmark of our country's legal system. He wants to ban people from Muslim-majority countries from entering the U.S. again. Sound familiar? And he hopes to end birthright citizenship, which is the practice where any child born on U.S. soil is granted citizenship, regardless of the status of their parents.
I want to jump in here because, I mean, everything you said about does it sound familiar is so true. We're talking about the Japanese internment camps during World War II that happened on our very soil, the Muslim ban after 9/11. Like, these are things that have already happened in our country's history, and he wants to bring them back. This whole birthright citizenship is the reason that there are more Asian immigrants or more Asian people in America now, because immigration policy until that point did not allow Asian people in. And with the establishment of birthright citizenship, we were able to extend it. But how would you say feel? I mean, I wonder how Trump supporters would feel if they realized that their white European counterparts who came over could not then have children who are U.S. citizens. Like, if we're extending this, can we look at it broadly at the broader implications? It is very, very frustrating when they're so narrowly focused on what this will do to immigrants and not really looking at what happens to the ripple effects of banning all immigrants from becoming citizens, basically.
I love that you made that point, because I think while Trump calls out specific countries and continents, like, those policies are going to apply to everyone. And so that is really, really important to not be distracted by who he's targeting, because he's targeting all of us, to be honest. Going back to his plans, he plans to deploy the National Guard and local law enforcement to round up perceived immigrants to enforce these policies, which, let's just put it right out there, this is a move that is unconstitutional, right? And would likely be challenged by the Supreme Court, which also, considering the court we have now, I don't know how that's going to go.
Right, which is terrifying. And also, I mean, Sasha, you're more of the history buff, so you might be able to recall this better than I can right now. But it reminds me of another time where we've talked about our enemies during World War II, and why was it that we targeted Japanese Americans? It was because you could visibly see who was of Japanese descent. You couldn't see who might be, say, of German descent during World War II. You couldn't see, if you're going to just look at the broad swath of white people. And so when you plan to deploy National Guards and people to round up perceived immigrants, who are the people who are going to be swept up in this? It could be any one of our friends and families who don't look like what they're trying to keep here, which is, from the sounds of it, white folks. Anybody who's not white is at risk of being swept up because they're a perceived immigrant, in my opinion.
Well, and if this sounds a lot like, I don't know, Nazi Germany, it does, because that was also another regime really based on perceived difference and selection based on that. And Sarah, you know, I appreciate that you have been talking about some of these implications, right, of these policies and how big they are, because these, what Trump says, the rhetoric alone, right, have really terrifying implications beyond, you know, November of this year. Researchers say that hate crimes against Hispanics spike when there is extensive media coverage involving Latinos, such as news about migrant caravans from Central America. Anti-Latino hate crime increased by an additional 2.8% in 2022 after a 41% increase in 2021 across major cities, including places like Los Angeles, Austin, and Chicago. More pointedly, a study by the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino found that since 2016, hate crimes against Latinos have spiked after comments made by Trump. Pew Research found that in 2020, nearly half or 48% of Latino people had serious concerns about their place in the country.
That's horrifying, right? Like, and it also goes back to the thing we teach our children, which is that words have consequences. What we say can translate into very real thoughts, feelings, and actions that may not actually be for the greater good. And this also very much reminds me of the rhetoric that spiked after COVID, when there was so much anti-Asian hate, and that turned into action against Asian folks. So I appreciate you talking about these implications and that the words matter.
Yeah. And, you know, I think like this is something that Anti-Racism Daily made a really careful point to say. And I think we can't say this part enough, right? Because there are some people who will feel compelled to vote for Trump, especially the single issue immigration voter, because of their frustration with how the Biden administration has handled immigration to this point. That is nuanced. But Trump's political stance, let's be really, really clear here. It is not a matter of national security. It's not grounded in economic reasoning. It's not even based on the principle of community safety. It is, however, a position rooted in white nationalism and hate, and reinforces the many other ways he's perpetuated white supremacy in his campaigning. Like, let's not forget Charlottesville and very good people on both sides. Because,
and I would also add that immigration was a challenge during Trump's former presidency as well. And there was nothing but bad that came of that, too. Like, if you recall, babies being split from family, like there was some not great stuff that happened at that point. Immigration has been a challenge. It has been around since the beginning of our country, and we have not come up with a consistently strong policy or responsive policy on either side of the political spectrum. This is a very difficult, complicated issue we're grappling with. And so I think it is very simplistic to say, well, I don't like this president or that president's response to it right now, right here, and therefore I'm going to vote based on this one issue. It is far too complex of an issue to make it your single issue that you're going to vote on.
Agreed. And I would be super wary of the person who's coming in with their quick fix solution, right? Because that is, to your point, Sarah, it is such a complex issue that there is no quick fix solution. So, you know, on that front, like I know we here at the podcast really love things like facts and truth.
Like true facts. Yeah.
The combination of the two is particularly special these days. But, you know, because I think it's really important to talk about what are the facts around immigration. Because as Heather Cox Richardson does a really good job of noting in her newsletters, and as reported by Catherine Rampell of the Washington Post, immigration is a key reason that the United States experienced greater economic growth than any other nation in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. The surge of immigration that began in 2022 brought to the U.S. working-age people who, Director Phil Swagel of the Nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office wrote, are expected to make the U.S. gross domestic product, or GDP, about $7 trillion larger over the next 10 years, from 2023 to 2034, than it would have been otherwise. Those workers will account for about $1 trillion in revenues, which is an astounding amount of money. Or like, if you are not concerned with economics, like let's look at what actual past Republican presidents have said. And let's start with, you know, or really focus on one of the most conservative and racist Republican presidents of our time, Ronald Reagan. As recently as 1989, Reagan noted with regard to immigration, "We lead the world because, unique among nations, we draw our people, our strength, from every country and every corner of the world. And by doing so, we continuously renew and enrich our nation. Thanks to each wave of new arrivals to this land of opportunity, we are a nation forever young, forever bursting with energy and new ideas, and always on the cutting edge, always leading the world to the next frontier. This quality is vital to our future as a nation. If we ever closed the door to new Americans, our leadership in the world would soon be lost."
Today, curious.
So interesting, really. So we've got facts that support immigration, Republican presidents who support immigration, and hate crime data that rise whenever negative and false rhetoric about immigration is spewed by Trump or MAGA Republicans or a combination of both. And yet, despite all of that, we have a presumptive nominee who is still telling us what he plans to do with immigrants, which is put them in incarceration camps, which is tell everyone that they are less than human, which is terrifying for all of us because immigrants might be first, but who's next? And like, this is the huge elephant in the room. Let's not forget that he effectively blocked a bipartisan immigration bill that would have provided much of the relief that both parties have been asking for about border issues. Why? Because he personally couldn't take credit for it. Let's just all let that sink in for a moment. Just,
Ouch.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we've covered immigration.
I'm excited to continue talking about some of these other issues because even just that made me like sink into my feelings and knowledge about why it was so wrong. Thank you for putting that part together.
Of course. Well, not to have you sink further into your feelings and knowledge about what might be wrong, let's transition to Ukraine and Ukraine aid, because we know that Trump is not in favor of that. And why not? Well, let's not forget that he not only supports Putin, let's not forget our Johnny from the past episodes, right, and Putin, but we have much more information about how Russian interference in the 2016 election helped Trump win. He doesn't forget the people who help him win.
Let's reemphasize that. That is truth. That is proven. That is like in the records. So don't dispute that.
But also we are, and you know, I like use this really sparingly, but I think this is actually accurate. We are really in an extraordinary moment, as Heather Cox Richardson wrote when talking about what foreign affairs journalist Ann Applebaum said on March 24th on Washington Week, which is this: Trump has decided that he doesn't want money to go to Ukraine. It's really an extraordinary moment. We have an out of power ex-president who is in effect dictating American foreign policy on behalf of a foreign dictator or with the interests of a foreign dictator in mind. I mean, let's just all think about that one for a second as your head slowly explodes.
Well, that makes my head explode. And I can hear skeptics, not that we have many skeptics listening to our particular show, right? But like, if say you're a Trump supporter, you'd be like, well, no, there's no proof. No, he's not doing that. It is costing us something to make these deals, including, I mean, you see the number of hacks that are coming in from foreign states like China and Russia right now, the amount of infrastructure in our country that is at risk based on the machinations of these nations that are out to gain influence and over our country. I mean, it's happening.
Well, even today, right, the news that like literally today, as we're recording this, the news came out that that people in Congress, even members of the Republican Party, are raising the flag that there is pro-Russian talking points being repeated in Congress, like, which is wild, people. Like, nothing about this is normal. And I think we are so desensitized now since 2016 that we take a lot of this like, oh, okay, that is not normal. Like, and I think this whole thing is not normal. And that is something that, Sarah, I think you and I can't say enough. Like, we can't be accepting this as okay, because it's not okay. It is wildly so outside the bounds of anything that we consider not even presidential authority, past presidential authority, like an American citizen's like rights, like almost in a parallel universe that we were having this discussion, but we're not. We are still in this one, which is the whole thing.
Well, and I think this takes us slightly off topic, but one of the thoughts that I had as you were saying that is it is possible that not many Americans have traveled abroad and don't understand what it means that we live in a democracy, right? We have lived in democracies for hundreds of years in this country. And yes, we have problems, but we have a lot of amazing things going for us. And they have no idea what it means to live in an authoritarian regime, to live in a kingdom, to live in an oppressed state. When people here talk about, oh, you know, save our freedoms. It's like, what freedoms are really like? We have some freedoms now that are finally coming actually under attack, but you have no idea. And so to spout support of a Russian authoritarian, like, dictator regime going on over there where, like, you have no idea what you're talking about and what you're supporting and what is at risk if we don't actually go back to words have impact. Think about what we're saying and what we're supporting and the longer term repercussions of that.
Yeah. Let's just say this one more time. With Trump's actions and words around Ukraine, we are normalizing this level of interference. We cannot do that, right? Because there is nothing that is normal about this, about an ex-president and current presumptive nominee who is trying to and actually kind of succeeding in directing U.S. foreign policy in a way that will definitely benefit a known dictator who typically murders his political rivals and can destabilize the world while so doing. It seems like all the other countries out there recognize this. Literally all of them. We just can't. But this is one of those moments where the call is coming from inside the house, friends.
That was powerful. All right. I'd love to chime in with a few things not to ignore, if that's okay. Because I think one of the things that it's important to note is that Trump hates the press.
Yeah, unless it's press that are, you know, pandering to him or whom he thinks he can control.
Oh, like Truth Social. Right, right. That platform. But as Dave Pell noted in a Next Draft newsletter from late March, one of the core tenets of authoritarianism, like you just mentioned regarding Russia, is to threaten, jail, and otherwise harm journalists, right? Authoritarianism, people like Evan Gershkovich, who from the Wall Street Journal, I mean, I think we still see, and I apologize if I mispronounced his name, but he's still locked up in Russia. He is a journalist, an American journalist who was locked up in Russia and is still there because of reporting. So when a sitting U.S. president calls the press the, quote, enemy of the people, it's probably not a good idea to rehire him. He said that in 2018.
And I watched the video of the rally in which he said that, so you don't have to. You're welcome.
But that is who he is, and that is who he will be. Do not think we're going to get a different version in 2024. And if anything, Misasha, you alluded to this earlier, we're getting a more strategic version of the guy who now has a playbook.
Literally called the Authoritarian Playbook 2025. And it's also out on the web for anyone to see.
Right? The playbook is about how to transform this country into a one-man show, which is really what he's always wanted.
Like, we just have to go into this for a second because, friends, this playbook is wild. And hopefully for those of you who are like, well, does he really mean what he says? Like, this discussion of the playbook helps to really cement that concept. Because as covered by Project Democracy, they did this whole report, which helped to explain how a second Trump administration would go about consolidating power at the federal policy level in service of really an agenda of retribution. Like, let's not think it's about others' interests. No, it is about retribution. So this goes even further than those statements that we talked about, because we don't even have to guess at who he is or what he thinks. He is telling us right here, friends. He is telling us. And like, I think it's really important to start where he starts, which is with his pledge to issue pardons for the January 6th insurrectionists, whom he's calling hostages, by the way, wild, and others who ignore the law or commit violence on his behalf, which is a move that seeks to place him and his allies outside the constraints of the law. Like, really important first step, because once you pardon everyone who supported you and yourself, right, then you have this sort of inscrutable power. In section two, it then turns to how he will pierce the independence of the Department of Justice to direct it to investigate and prosecute perceived critics or opinions. And if you think this sounds a lot like Russia, because it does, right? This is what authoritarian regimes do. People who speak out against them get persecuted, get hunted down, sometimes get killed. All right. His weaponization of the powers of government may begin with the criminal justice system, but it won't end there, because a third section examines how he will politicize regulatory agencies using their many administrative tools, licenses, permits, contracts, regulatory waivers, to force loyalty and really crack down on anyone who disagrees with him. And if that wasn't bad enough, then he turns to more direct uses of government force, because Section 4 addresses Trump's plans for using the Department of Homeland Security agents as a domestic police force. Let's just wait there for a second. He is going to use the Department of Homeland Security forces as a domestic police force. Like, that in and of itself is so wild. So wild. Section 5 considers his plans to deploy not just federal law enforcement, but the U.S. military here in the United States. And Section 6 considers Trump's repeated suggestions that, like other autocrats around the world, like Putin, you know, who just won, what, his 21st election or something wild like that, he might not leave office when a second term is up.
So keep breathing. Keep breathing. But if that brief synopsis blew your mind and also left you wondering, how have I never heard about this before? This is your invitation to do a little sleuthing, because I had not heard of all that before. My brain is currently exploding. And to see, I think it's important for us to see that what the news media covers and what it does not, right? We have to figure out what the facts are and to cement what we may have feared all along, but do not want to know concretely. We do know this concretely. He published the Authoritarian Playbook 2025. We know how reelecting him will turn out. And spoiler alert, it turns out poorly for all of us. So going back then to the power of words, on the topic of Trump's words in particular, please remember his words and actions continually, intentionally incite violence, right? We only have to look at his recent trials to get a good snapshot of this. And I'm going to ask Misasha, our resident lawyer, can you be the one to talk about the trials?
Yeah. And I like, let's just say that this is also way outside the bounds of a normal reality in which our presumptive presidential nominee has multiple trials going on at the same time for things like inciting a coup. Anyway, for example, on Tuesday, March 26th, Judge Juan Merchan, who is presiding over Trump's election interference case, put Trump under a gag order to stop his attacks on court staff, prosecutors, jurors, and witnesses. The next day, Trump renewed his attacks on the judge and the judge's daughter because A, he doesn't care about rules, and B, nothing is off limits for him. On Thursday, U.S. District Judge Reggie Walton took the unusual step of talking publicly about what threats of violence mean to the rule of law. Walton, who was appointed to the federal bench by President George W. Bush, a Republican president, let's not forget, told Caitlin Collins of CNN that threats, especially threats to a judge's family, undermine the ability of judges to carry out their duties. I think it's important in order to preserve our democracy that we maintain the rule of law, Walton said. And the rule of law can only be maintained if we have independent judicial officers who are able to do their job and ensure that the laws are, in fact, enforced and that the laws are applied equally to everybody who appears in our courthouse.
Which is so telling for a guy who says he really wants law and order, which we don't need to go on a tangent about how that's a dog whistle for other stuff. But the hypocrisy continues to be amazing, right? And if what you just shared was not disgusting enough, that Friday, former President Trump shared on social media a video of a truck with a decal showing President Joe Biden tied up and seemingly in the bed of the truck in a position suggesting he was being kidnapped, right? So again, a threat of violence has always been a part of Trump's political performance. Back in 2016, he urged rallygoers to, quote, knock the crap out of protesters. And they did. They also turned on people who weren't protesters. There were three political scientists who studied the effects of Trump's 2016 campaign rhetoric against marginalized Americans, and they found that counties where Trump held rallies had a significant increase in hate incidents in the months after that rally.
And I know that we have probably collectively tried to block out some of these next things that we're going to talk about, but I think it's really important to remember these because this is who he is. Because Trump's stoking of violence became like actually kind of an embrace of who he is when he declared that there were very fine people on both sides after protesters stood up against racist, anti-Semites, white nationalists, KKK members, neo-Nazis, and other alt-right groups in August 2017 in Charlottesville, Virginia. If you remember that, they shouted Nazi slogans and left 19 people injured and one protester, Heather Heyer, dead. In October 2020, Trump refused to denounce the far-right Proud Boys organization, instead telling its members to stand back and stand by. The Proud Boys turned out for the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, where they helped to lead those rioters fired up by Trump's speech at the Ellipse, where he told them, "You'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength and you have to be strong. We have come to demand that Congress do the right thing, and we fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore." And, you know, that is actually kind of tame because Trump's appeals to violence have gotten even more overt since the events of January 6th. And yet, Burgess Everett and Olivia Beavers of Politico reported in early April that nearly 20 Republican lawmakers and aides have told them they would like Trump to calm down his rhetoric. They appear to think such violent commentary is unpopular and that it will hurt those running in down ballot races if they have to answer for it, which is so interesting. And yet another sort of huge glaring sign that Trump is really only in this for himself, because it's going to hurt the party candidates as a whole. He doesn't care. He's still going to do it, because it seems unlikely Trump will willingly temper his comments, since threatening violence seems to be all he has left to combat the legal cases that are really starting to crush him.
Right. As a case in point, over the course of Easter morning, he posted more than 70 times on social media attacking his opponents and declaring himself to be the chosen one. I don't think we even have time to get into his selling the Bibles and his link to and weaponization of evangelical Christianity here. But to follow this thread, notice whose voices are not denouncing him. And why do you think that may be the case?
Going back to his attacks on Judge Mershon, in early April also, Judge Mershon expanded the previous gag order on Trump to stop attacks on the judge's family members. Trump has a right, quote, to speak to the American voters freely and defend himself publicly, but it is no longer just a mere possibility or a reasonable likelihood that there exists a threat to the integrity of the judicial proceedings, Mershon wrote. The threat is very real. One final note. As I was literally typing up this episode, as predicted, and as we discussed at the top of the episode, Sarah, Trump's latest comment about abortion hit all of the news channels. You know, the one where he says, "My view is now that we have abortion where everyone wanted it from a legal standpoint. The states will determine by vote or legislation, or perhaps both. And whatever they decide must be the law of the land. In this case, the law of the state." Now here, I want to be consistent and say we should take him at his word. In which case, I would also assume that based on what we just saw from the authoritarian playbook 2025, all of the states would be under his control anyway, so he could impose a federal abortion ban without it having to be federal in nature. Or, as he actually lays out in the playbook, he replaced the head of the FDA, so any approval of, like, really any abortion drugs would be rescinded. And he'd use the DOJ to ensure that the Comstock Act, which is the 19th century law that makes it illegal to ship obscene materials, would be used to stop the mailing of abortion medication or supplies. I mean, and this isn't even my guess, this is what the playbook says. And let's not forget that he's always taken credit for overturning Roe. But I also want to say that for statements that he makes, which marks a drastic turn from what he said before, and I would put this statement in this category, we have to ask ourselves, why the change? What does he stand to gain from this? And as Dave Pell notes, a serial sexual assaulter who bragged about getting abortion banned, declared that rape should be an exception, and the media covered that as a normal policy announcement. That is so wild. So wild. I know I've said that about 25 times this episode, but that is the general theme. So there's that too, right? Because as we've repeatedly said, Trump is not out there for anyone else besides himself. His actions are first and foremost about his own personal gain, not having to pay taxes, pardoning his own actions and being the first sitting president to incite a coup against the government, getting away with rape and sexual assault. The list goes on. So we need to take him at his word. And we have to ask ourselves why. And we've got to do that every day. We can't look away, because in the end, a 2024 win for Trump means that we all lose.
You've just listened to the Dear White Women podcast with your hosts, Sarah and me, Sasha. Yes, we're on social media. And yes, you can hire us to do talks about our book. But the biggest thing, don't forget to sign up for our newsletter to receive our free materials. Head over to dearwhitewomen.com to get on the list.